Usually, when you look at two massive tectonic plates just crashing into each other, you kind of expect one thing.
Total chaos.
Exactly. Like total chaotic destruction. You just assume every single structure on the surface is going to be shattered into completely unrecognizable pieces.
I mean, it's the most natural assumption in the world. When the friction is that violent and the forces are so diametrically opposed, it just feels entirely binary.
Right.
You see the collapse, and you really don't think to look for, well, what actually survives the pressure?
That's spot on. But today, we're taking a deep dive into a wildly unusual document that kind of forces us to look underneath all that surface
It
destruction.
really
It's
does.
a source document titled Common Grounds for Peace, and it attempts something incredibly difficult. It literally maps out exactly 100 shared fundamental human values, religious ethics, and practical interests between Iran and Israel.
Which is just a mind-blowing premise.
It is. And just to be completely clear right out of the gate, so you, the listener, know exactly what this deep dive is about. We aren't taking any political sides here.
No, absolutely not.
We are not endorsing any foreign policies, no geopolitical arguments or factions, nothing like that. The mission today is strictly to explore this document impartially, as this really fascinating intellectual exercise. Because what it claims, it basically changes how you view a conflict zone.
It genuinely does because the core thesis of this document isn't some naive utopian denial of the war.
Right, it's not ignoring reality.
Exactly. It doesn't pretend the conflict isn't devastating. Instead, it identifies what the authors call stationary invariance.
Stationary
Yeah.
invariance.
So if you think about the architecture of a skyscraper in an earthquake zone, the stationary invariants are the absolute core structural beams that do not bend.
Oh, I see.
Right. They are designed to hold the weight of the entire building. So in the context of this source document, these are the foundational moral and cultural values that both nations hold so deeply that abandoning them wouldn't just mean changing a policy.
It would mean entirely losing their own respective identities.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this.
Well.
Because the idea of beams that do not bend between two societies locked in such a fierce existential opposition, it's just wild.
It is.
And the document doesn't even start with like high-level diplomacy. It starts in the living room, right? It looks the cultural mirror of compassion and justice.
Yeah, because if you want to know the true nature of a society, you look at how they treat the vulnerable and how they treat the stranger at the door.
Right, the everyday stuff.
That is the ultimate litmus test for any culture. And what the source points out is the massive, almost gravitational weight both societies place on the concept of hospitality.
Yes, I was reading this part and it's fascinating.
In the Iranian tradition, you have the social principle of tearoff. And then in the Israeli tradition, you have the Jewish concept of haknasat orkum. And we really need to understand the mechanism here because these aren't just polite suggestions to, offer a visiting neighbor a cup of tea.
Right. Tear-off is famous for being this incredibly complex system of social etiquette.
Oh, absolutely.
It's the reason why, like, if you go to a Persian restaurant, you might see two friends practically fighting a war over who gets the privilege of paying the bill.
Yeah, it looks like a fight.
It looks like a polite disagreement, but it's actually a profound cultural imperative about deference, right? Honoring the other person and humbling yourself. It's woven into the fabric of daily negotiation.
And haknasat orkum operates on the exact same psychological and social level. It literally translates to bringing in the guests, but historically, it was about protecting the traveler who had nowhere else to sleep. You don't just feed the stranger, you protect their dignity. And the source document expands on this by looking at how this everyday hospitality is actually scaled up into an entire agricultural economic system.
This was one of the most striking details to me. Both cultures have these ancient laws dictating how a farmer is allowed to harvest a field.
Yes.
So, in Islamic tradition, you have the zakat, which is a form of almsgiving treated almost as a religious tax.
Yeah.
And in Jewish tradition, you have the law of piyah.
And the mechanism of pia is fascinating.
It really is. Like, if you own a farm, you are legally and morally forbidden from harvesting your field. All the way to the absolute edges.
You literally have to drive your harvester or take your scythe and intentionally leave the corners untouched.
Which goes against every capitalist instinct, right? But why do they do it? Because that portion is designated specifically for the poor, the widow, and the orphan.
And notice the how of that mechanism, though. You don't harvest the grain, bake the bread, and then hand it out like a charity line.
Right, which can strip a person of their pride.
Exactly. You leave the raw resource in the field so the vulnerable person can come and collect it themselves, maintaining their autonomy and their dignity.
That is profound. It's institutionalized empathy.
It really is. And the document argues powerfully that this empathy isn't an accident. It is deeply rooted in shared historical pain.
So the trauma basically defines the architecture.
Precisely. Both nations have modern psychological narratives that are profoundly shaped by collective trauma.
Right.
For Israel, it is the unimaginable systemic horrors of the Holocaust. And for Iran, it is the absolute devastation of the incredibly bloody Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s, which was followed by decades of crippling international sanctions.
Yeah, you look at the Iran-Iraq war, it was a trench warfare meat grinder. It left a scar on almost every single family in Iran.
It really did.
And the key takeaway from the source here is how both societies utilize that immense historical grief. They don't just bury it. They use it as fuel for a vow to prevent future suffering for their own people.
You see it in their mourning rituals, right?
Yeah, exactly. Both societies have these moments where the entire country essentially just grinds to a halt to weep for their fallen soldiers. Mm. It's a unifying, completely visceral experience of collective grief.
But collective grief and ancient agricultural laws don't automatically stop a bad employer from exploiting a worker today.
It's true. True.
What's fascinating here is how these historical emotional touchstones are translated into cold, hard, modern jurisprudence. These shared values are actually codified directly into their contemporary legal systems.
It's like looking at two neighbors who are locked in a bitter, explosive feud, right? Throwing rocks over the fence at each other all day long.
Yeah, good analogy.
But if you were to walk inside their respective houses and look at the list of rules pinned to the fridge, they're enforcing the exact same strict household rules of decency.
Right, like Iran's modern labor code and Israel's modern wage protection law. They're designed with the exact same moral baseline. Depriving a worker of their rightful earnings isn't just a breach of contract. It is fundamentally viewed as a moral injustice that offends the foundation of the state.
Because the state laws are built on top of a shared spiritual and philosophical bedrock.
Exactly.
And that brings us to the underlying theology of reverence that both societies share. Why do they legally protect the vulnerable?
Because they both fundamentally believe, at a core theological level, that every single human being is created in the divine image.
Right. In Islamic theology, this concept is karama, the inherent inviolable dignity of the human being. And in Judaism, it's Tselem Elohim, being made in the image of God.
And if you actually believe that the person standing in front of you reflects the divine, it completely changes the calculus of how you are allowed to treat them. You just can't discard them.
And they apply this exact same reverence to the physical ground. Both traditions look at the exact same geography, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and revere it as an axis of the holy.
It's a shared geography of absolute devotion. But true reverence demands a specific internal posture. You can't be purely egotistical and deeply reverent at the same time.
Right. And that's where the source dives into these centuries-old mystical practices. Both cultures have these esoteric traditions entirely focused on the mechanics of self-emptying.
Yes.
In the Islamic Sufi tradition, this is the concept of fana, the passing away of the self, the destruction of the ego, so you can actually perceive the divine and make room for the other.
And in Jewish Kabbalah, you have the exact parallel concept of bitul, the nullification of the ego.
Wow.
And it isn't just a philosophical exercise for monks either. It's programmed into the societal calendar. Both societies have a designated weekly rest day, Friday or Jumu'ah for Muslims, and Saturday, Shabbat for Jews.
And the source is very clear that this isn't just about taking a nap or having a weekend off.
No, not at all.
The actual mechanism of these rest days is explicitly designed to be a hard break on human greed. You are commanded to stop the machinery of commerce. You have to shut down the forced labor of the work week.
It is a mandated society-wide practice of humility, reminding everyone that there is a higher authority than pure capitalism, industry, or your own ambition.
It creates a rhythm of ego death every 7 days.
That's a great way to put it.
Okay, stop right there. Here's where it gets really interesting, but also where I have to play devil's advocate for a second.
Sure, go for it.
I buy the hospitality. I buy the poetry and the shared calendar. It is easy to talk about tear off and blessing bread or wine around a dining room table.
Yeah.
But if I am a 4-star military general Or if I am the head of a covert intelligence agency planning a kinetic strike, I mean, I am not using self-emptying mysticism to plan my operations.
Right.
The brutal mechanics of a modern state at war do not run on Sufi poetry. How does the author honestly reconcile that? Does this document actually bridge the massive gap between the monastery and the battlefield?
That is the exact challenge the document anticipates. It doesn't claim that generals are sitting around practicing mysticism in the war room.
Okay, good.
It claims that the cultural expectation of humility forces even the most rigid, ego-driven state apparatuses to bend. The source points out specific historical examples of institutional humility.
Like what?
Well, look at the intelligence communities of both Iran and Israel. These are organizations built on projecting infallibility and supreme competence. Yet, both have been catastrophically wrong in the past.
Right.
And more importantly, they have been forced by their own internal cultures to admit those failures.
That is a deeply unnatural thing for an intelligence agency to do.
Exactly. But they do it because they know the visceral survival value of admitting a miscalculation. The document notes that military commanders on both sides have historically had to stand up and admit tactical mistakes.
Wow.
Not to be polite, but specifically to prevent the future senseless deaths of their own soldiers. The structural beam of humility, the requirement to say, I was wrong so my people can live, it exists even within their most guarded military hierarchies.
Wow. So the societal fauna or betul forces a general to swallow their pride because the culture demands it. That perfectly sets up how these theoretical values survive the brutal pragmatism of statecraft and crisis. The source outlines how both nations have had to dramatically change course after incredibly humbling, disastrous wars.
Yeah.
For Israel, it was the shock of the Yom Kippur War in 1973, which completely shattered their illusion of military invincibility.
And for Iran, as we mentioned earlier, it was the horrifying stalemate of the Iran-Iraq War. Both of those conflicts forced the state to look inward, recognize their absolute limits, and pivot their strategies.
Because they couldn't just double down on arrogance.
Yeah.
The cost in human life was just too high.
Right.
And what blew my mind reading this is how deeply personal religious rituals of confession mirror these massive state actions. Like, both cultures have profound rituals that require the spoken, verbal naming of a sin. You can't just feel bad about it silently.
Right, you have to vocalize it.
Exactly. In Islam, it is the practice of istighfar, seeking forgiveness by acknowledging the wrong. In Judaism, it's the tradition of tashlik, where you symbolically cast off your sins into moving water.
The mechanism is identical. You must bring the dark thing into the light, name it, and only then can you be free of its weight.
And we have seen this agonizing mechanism play out at the highest levels of the state.
We have.
The document cites highly specific, incredibly painful historical moments, like Iran formally stepping forward, apologizing, and admitting fault for the tragic accidental downing of civilian flight PS-752.
And Israel publicly apologizing for the Kfar Qassim massacre.
Yeah, these are rare, legally and politically fraught moments of state-level confession. But they happen because the cultural imperative to name the sin occasionally overpowers the political instinct to cover it up.
Which brings us to a really crucial technical concept in the document, the CCT framework.
Right, the CCT framework.
The source explicitly names this as the conflict, culture, and theology framework. And what this framework basically argues is that ancient religious wisdom actively dictates and regulates wartime pragmatics.
It's not just background noise.
Exactly. It is the operating manual for how far a war is allowed to go.
So how does it actually work in practice?
Well, the CCT framework is the bridge between the holy text and the hostage negotiation. The document gives a brilliant example regarding the religious ethic of returning a lost item to an enemy.
Okay.
On the surface, that sounds like a lovely ancient fable, right? If
Good.
Your enemy's ox wanders off, you return it. But the CCT framework shows how that exact theological principle translates directly into both nations, utilizing complex third-party intermediaries to return the remains of captured soldiers.
Think about the logistics of that. You are in the middle of a bitter proxy war, yet you are secretly working through diplomats in a neutral country just to hand over the physical remains of a combatant.
It's incredible.
And why do they do it? Because the CCT framework dictates the invariant of reciprocity. Even in the absolute bitterest throes of conflict, the physical remains of a human being, because they are made in the divine image, demand respect.
Right. You do not desecrate the dead, because doing so would desecrate your own religion.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the source introduces an incredible analogy for metallurgy.
Heat points.
Oh, I love this part. Yeah, in metalworking, a heat point is the exact temperature at which a rigid piece of metal will begin to bend or warp. The document argues that this ongoing geopolitical war is a furnace, testing how far each side's morality will bend under extreme heat.
But these shared actions, honoring secret back channels, returning remains, sticking to the rules of engagement regarding the dead, prove that there is a hard limit. Bending any further would break their own moral codes.
They would cease to be the holy nations they claim to be.
Exactly. And speaking of the heat point, the source brings up the history of mutual aid.
Yeah, this part is wild.
If you just read the daily news, this sounds impossible, but the document details how, historically, Iran has facilitated help to Israel during severe earthquakes, and Israel has offered or sent aid to Iran after devastating floods.
Because when the tectonic plates of the earth literally shift and crush a city, the theological imperative instantly supersedes the political enmity. Nature provides a reset button on the conflict.
Exactly. It is so striking to realize that both sides share this absolute, non-negotiable religious obligation to rescue a neighbor in mortal danger.
Right. In Judaism, it is the principle of pekuch nefesh, the ruling that saving a human life overrides virtually every other religious law. Mm. You can break the Sabbath, you can break dietary laws if it means saving a life.
And in Islam, there is an equally profound foundational imperative that saving one life is akin to saving all of humanity.
And that shared imperative is why the document highlights medical ethics. The medical associations on both sides, the doctors and nurses working in the trauma wards, they treat wounded combatants, even declared enemies, under these shared professional and spiritual ethics.
Because a doctor's duty to the bleeding human body in front of them is a stationary invariant.
It cannot be bent by the political flag stitched onto the patient's uniform.
It really can't.
It's heavy, you know? The mechanisms of survival are intense. Mm. But what I appreciate about this deep dive into the source material is that it doesn't end in the trauma ward.
No, it doesn't.
It asks a critical question about the future. How do the everyday citizens of these nations, the people who aren't generals or politicians, carry on under the crushing psychological weight of a seemingly endless conflict?
They carry on through defiant acts of hope, which are just as structurally sound as the laws of war.
Yeah.
The document points to agriculture again, but this time looking forward. On both sides of this conflict, you have farmers actively planting new olive groves and pistachio orchards.
And the mechanism of hope there is biological. You don't plant an olive tree for a quick payout. It takes years, sometimes decades, for those trees to mature and yield a harvest.
A farmer planting a sapling is making a generational bet.
Exactly. They're betting that their grandchildren will be alive and in peace to harvest that fruit, despite the very real threat that a missile strike could uproot the entire field tomorrow.
Alongside the farmers, you have scientists in both countries pouring their entire careers into developing drought-resistant seeds. It is a shared, stubborn, highly technical refusal to let the soil of the Middle East die. They are engineering life to survive the harshness of the climate, mirroring their own survival.
But when science and agriculture aren't enough to soothe the anxiety of the conflict, both societies share a deep reliance on their artists. The source notes that citizens of both nations turn to their poets to make sense of the long, dark nights of war.
Yes.
It specifically highlights the Persian poet Hafez and the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai.
And there is a specific reason why poetry matters here. Prose, news reports, and political speeches fail to capture the contradiction of everyday life going on amidst historical tragedy.
Right.
Poets like Hafez and Amichai write about the intersection of making a cup of tea while the world is falling apart. They are the voices the citizens turn to when the political rhetoric becomes hollow.
So what does this all mean? When you, the listener, are taking all this in, you're likely thinking about the stark, almost jarring contrast between these 100 common grounds and the violent headlines you see every morning.
Oh, definitely.
What this document is really trying to convey is the sheer emotional weight of human endurance. It is about artists in both nations figuring out how to create beautiful, intricate mosaics out of broken, shattered tiles.
It's about the resilience of the human spirit when the geopolitical furnace pushes it to the absolute brink.
Exactly.
This raises an important question for you to consider as we wrap this up. What stands out to you when you hear how closely mapped these two populations are?
Yeah.
The foundational architecture of their humanity is practically a mirror image. They both navigate the exact same fears. They utilize the exact same theological coping mechanisms. They honor their dead with the same reverence, and they both desperately wish for the dawn.
It is a mirror.
Yeah.
And to summarize the true value of the source document, its power lies in what it deliberately ignores.
Yes.
It strips away the press conferences, the posturing, the endless scrolling feed of outrage.
Yeah.
And underneath all of that noise, it finds 100 structural beings of shared humanity. It proves that even in the bitterest, most deeply entrenched conflicts on the planet, fundamental human values remain stationary invariants. The empathy, the rules of hospitality, the limits of war they do not bend.
And maintaining those moral boundaries isn't a sign of weakness in a brutal world. As the conflict, culture, and theology framework concludes, protecting those invariants is actually the only viable, realistic path to any future peace.
Because if you lose the values, there's nothing left to make peace with.
Exactly.
So the next time you find yourself doom-scrolling, feeling completely overwhelmed and cynical about global conflicts, try to remember this framework.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Look past the friction of the tectonic plates. Look for the invariants of human dignity, the shared agricultural laws, the deep cultural mandates of charity that the daily headlines just don't have the time to explain to you.
Look for the structural beams holding the house together.
Which leaves us with one final and honestly pretty provocative thought for you to mull over as you go about your day. We started by talking about the destruction of an earthquake and the invisible structural beams that hold a building up.
Right.
If these shared values, these heat points, are the absolute limits that cannot be bent without a nation losing its very soul, what happens to the internal fabric of a society when the relentless demands of an endless war finally push it to violate its own most sacred stationary invariants?
Yeah.
When a state is forced to bend those moral beams past their breaking point, does the society completely shatter under the pressure? Or does the shock of that break finally cause the people to wake up?